to live in Chicago, the popular saying was, vote early and vote often. But Be'ezrat Hashem, I was going to say we should get the leadership we deserve, but maybe that's not the best. Maybe that's not the best way of saying it. We should get the leadership that we need, whether we deserve it or not. And talking about leadership, that's a wonderful segue into the Ramban, who of course was one of the great, great leaders of Judaism. And today we will not yet begin the actual Vikuach HaRamban. What I'm going to try to do for you by next week is I will make a copy of both in English and the Hebrew translation. It's only 6 pages, so it's not a major thing. And then next week we'll actually begin looking at the contents of the debate. Today I do want to continue a little bit about biographical information about Ramban, and in particular the nature of the settlement in Eretz Yisrael when the Ramban got there in 1267. That's also a very, very interesting part of our history, and it's part of our history that's a bit obscure and not very well known. First of all, you'll remember, without going over the whole biography of the Ramban, that in 1265, he was summoned by King James of Aragon to publicly debate the truths of Christianity. The initiator of the debate, the one who actually went to the king, was an apostate Jew, a Jew who had converted to Christianity, who went by the name Pablo Christiani. Obviously, that was his assumed name. And he was a skilled talker, debater, and he thought this was a good occasion where he could have a little fun and revenge and vengeance against the rabbis that he hated. And the Ramban was summoned to this debate. Someone just asked me before the class, what would have been if the Ramban would have said no? I honestly don't know. There are two possibilities. In other words, why did he say yes to begin with? I mean, there are two possibilities. One is that this is an offer you can't refuse, quoting the Godfather, meaning to say, who would have known what the consequences would have been? But number two, I think there may be a religious motive, and that is, if the rabbi, the greatest rabbi in Spain, refuses to debate Christian theology, there are some Jews who might take the position that Judaism is not defensible. So the Ramban had to be very, very concerned not to portray the Torah as weak and unable to answer various attacks. So although it's very, very clear that the Ramban did not seek out this opportunity to debate, once it is offered, he felt he could not decline. And in 1265, there was a debate. As they say, it's a very odd debate because Pablo Christiani, as we will see next week, Pablo Christianity's methodology was to try to show that the Talmud itself accepted, the rabbis of the Talmud accepted Jesus as both a Messiah and God. And the Ramban's counterargument was, you are distorting the meaning of Talmudic passages. Now, initially, that itself is kind of a bizarre position. If the rabbis of the Talmud wanted to accept Jesus, they could have said it in any number of very explicit ways. So the whole debate was kind of in a very odd point, because it was not arguing ultimate truths. It was simply arguing what are the inferences to be made from Jewish texts. Be it as it may, again, I don't want to go over all of that now because we're going to start that next week. But as you know, the debate only lasted 4 sessions. The Franciscans wanted to terminate it because it wasn't going their way. And they said, let's just stop it here. Like pull the plug on the debate, they wanted the Ramban to be banished from Spain. King James liked the Ramban. In fact, King James gave the Ramban a 300 silver piece reward and said, I've never heard such an articulate defense of that which is untrue. But nevertheless, he says, you did a great, great job defending the indefensible, and he gave him money. And he didn't want to get rid of Ramban. He liked Ramban. Ramban was a moral force. He was kind of King James's rabbi, just like Emanuel Jacobowitz was Margaret Thatcher's rabbi. And what eventually happened was, eventually he caved into pressure, and he ordered banishment of the Ramban for 2 years. It was supposed to be a 2-year banishment. What happened was the Franciscans went to the higher authority, Pope Clement, who basically said that because Ramban has defamed the faith, his punishment was a lifetime banishment. So in the year 1267, 2 years after the debate, the Ramban made Aliyah, and he lived in the land of Israel for 3 years. So from 1267 to 1270, and the Ramban died in Eretz Yisrael and the like. Now, initially, his first stop was Yerushalayim, but he stayed in Yerushalayim for less than a year. And then he went to Akko. And Akko, by far, was the largest Jewish community. So let me just explain a little bit why Akko became very prominent. To go back way before the Ramban, let's go back to... I'm not going to give you all the dates because it's very bewildering. But 1096 was the year of the First Crusade. And by 1099, 3 years later, the Crusaders had conquered the Holy Land. They had conquered all of Eretz Israel. But they established their capital center at Akko, because Akko was a major port and it was relatively easy to get supplies to and from Europe and regiments, etc. So Akko did become the capital of the Christian Kingdom of Jerusalem, as it was called. But what happened was Muslims fought ferociously, and there were battles for over 100 years, and eventually a type of short-term treaty was made where the Muslims got Jerusalem, and the Crusaders kept their kingdom of, they called it Kingdom of Jerusalem, but the Kingdom of Jerusalem was in Akko. It kind of reminds me, I remember getting a property tax bill from Montgomery County, Maryland, that was mailed from Pennsylvania. Somehow they farmed it out or something. Yeah. So similarly, the Kingdom of Jerusalem did not include Jerusalem at this time. It only included Akko and the north. So the thing you need to know is that Jerusalem in particular was a flashpoint of constant wars between Christians and Muslims, going back and forth like a football. And at the time that the Ramban came to Eretz Yisrael, Jerusalem was under Muslim control, and the Muslims were much less tolerant of Jewish observances at that time than were the Christians, and therefore the Ramban writes, there was not even a minyan of Jews in Jerusalem, and although the Ramban did establish a Beit Knesset, he eventually went to Akko. Now, one thing you need to know about Akko, so he came to Akko 1267, 1268, and he died in Akko, and according to most traditions, he is buried in Akko, although I mentioned one of the anomalies is, why do we not know exactly where the Ramban is buried? Now, you need to know one other date, I don't want to overwhelm you with dates, and that is, in 1211, this is more than 50 years before the Ramban came, 1267, in 1211, when the Ramban was still in Spain, and this is way before the disputation at Barcelona, 300 French rabbis and their families made Aliyah and settled in Akko. And these were of the great rabbis who were the Balei HaTosfos. Many of them were the ones who wrote the annotations on the Gemara. These were great Talmudic scholars. In fact, the leader of them was one of the greatest of the Balei Tosfos. He is Rabbeinu Shimshon of Kusi. He's called Hasar Mikutsi. In yeshiva learning, he is known as the Rash, not the Rosh, the Rash, Resh Shin. And he truly was an exceptionally great scholar of Torah, but also a great leader. He galvanized a whole community of 300 people to simply make Aliyah under very, very difficult conditions. Initially, they too went to Jerusalem much earlier, but couldn't make it there. They went up to Akko, which was a well-settled community, albeit under Christian control. It is said, if you look, one of the unique contributions of the Rash is that there is no Babylonian Talmud on the Mishnaic orders of Zerayim, which are agriculture, and Taharot, the laws of purity and impurity, except for Maseches Nida. There is no Babylonian Talmud. There's a Jerusalem Talmud on agriculture, and there's not even a Jerusalem Talmud on the laws of purity and impurity. And the reason is because in the Galut, the laws of agriculture were not that relevant, Shemitah and the like. And when there's no Beit HaMikdash, even in Israel, the laws of purity and impurity were less prevalent. But perhaps the greatest commentary on the orders of Zerayim and Tarot is the commentary of the Rash. The Rash wrote extensive commentaries on both of these orders. And it is quite reasonable to speculate that part of what motivated him to devote his kochot to those neglected parts of the Torah was his great desire to come to Eretz Yisrael and to establish a Jewish settlement in Eretz Yisrael. And therefore, he wanted to master the laws of agriculture as well as the laws of Tumah V'Tarah. So interestingly enough, throughout the 13th century, there was a great, great, comparatively speaking, a great wave of Olim. Now, again, numerically, it was not that significant, but if you look at the writings of the time, there was a great deal of talk about coming up to Eretz Israel. They saw this as a real possibility. There is even some anecdotal evidence that the Rash and some of his disciples attempted to bring a Korban Pesach and the Temple Mount. Again, it was then under Islamic control. Some things don't change. It's kind of under Islamic control even today. But this is pre, how old is the Mosque of Omar? I'm not sure if this was pre-Mosque of Omar or not.
700.
So it was already, the mosque was already there. But be it as it may, if you look at the writings of the Balei HaTosfos, you actually see a lively debate. Some rabbis said, Aliyah doesn't make sense. Hardships are too great. Pikuach nefesh. You won't be able to keep the mitzvot in Eretz Yisrael. You can do it better in France and Germany, which had settled Jewish communities. Others say the other way around. Again, the debate is very contemporary. How can you turn your back on the holiness of the land? And you can actually collect a whole book of active, live debates between these different Rishonim about coming to Eretz Yisrael, not coming to Eretz Yisrael. Most people obviously didn't come. But of course, that has nothing to do with our current situation. I mean, in those days, the hardships of coming to a land, as well as being dominated by Christians and Muslims, were very, very different than the hardships today. Today, we have the hardship of a 12-hour LL flight, which again, I acknowledge that it's a hardship, as well as a higher price for Ben and Jerry's. These are the hardships of life in Eretz Yisrael. They should not be compared at all to what the hardships of life were in those days. Like I remember reading, just in the 20th century, Golda Meir's autobiography. And, she came from Russia, but she grew up in Milwaukee and then comes to Israel in the 1920s. And she discusses what life was like. You're sleeping in the mud, surrounded by mosquitoes, as you're digging the ditches and building the roads. And it's just quite amazing what people went through, the Chalutzim went through, just to build a Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael. So you have to give them credit, religious, not religious. I mean, they made hardships and sacrifices and things that are totally, virtually unimaginable for us today. So one should be very wary about using the non-Aliyah precedents of the Rishonim to extrapolate them into some argument for today, because the conditions are, Baruch Hashem, not at all comparable. But be it as it may, the Rash, who was one of the greatest Gedolei Hador, did establish a great yeshiva in Akko. And this was the yeshiva which used the methodology of the Balei HaTosfos. Again, I mentioned last week that the unique methodology of the Balei HaTosfos is that when they would analyze passages of the Talmud, they would not simply look for the meaning of this passage, but they would compare it to all analogous passages. And they would try to create a synthesis and a harmonization. In fact, it is recorded that every student, these are advanced students obviously, was responsible to master one tractate of the Talmud. Each one was mastered a different tractate. So one did Chulin, one did Bava Metzia, and the concept would be that whenever they're learning any tractate, if there's some contradiction from some other Maseches, there would be a student that would be able to point it out. So if we're learning Bava Metzia, and there's something in Maseches Shabbat that contradicts Bava Metzia, there's the Shabbat guy that is supposed to say, hey, this is a contradiction. So everybody mastered that piece of the Talmud so that the entire Talmud could be brought to bear on any discussion. This is the unique contribution of what we call the Balei HaTosos. Remember, the school was started by Rashi's own grandchildren, but it expanded to really hundreds and hundreds of rabbis. The Rash was one of the greatest of them, and he started the yeshiva in this way initially in France and then in Akko itself. Now this goes back to 1211. Remember, this is 50 years before the Ramban came. Now the Ramban came, as I say, initially to Yerushalayim. He established a Beit Knesset. He wrote his commentary on the Torah in Eretz Israel. But eventually he did live in Akko and he died in Akko. And I had mentioned last week a fascinating point that we do have a record, a written record, of a very long drasha that the Ramban gave on Rosh Hashanah in Akko. So I think I mentioned last week that as a an ex-synagogue rabbi, I was very interested in the length of the drasha because this was clearly a transcript of an oral drasha, and it is so long that it would take at least 2.5 hours. To give. So I was thinking to myself, would I get away with a 2.5 hour drasha? For sure not. I think in the middle of Rosh Hashanah they would start another minyan and finish up. So I actually read, I don't know what the proof is, I actually read that some historians say this was a pre-Rosh Hashanah drasha. This was actually not given on Rosh Hashanah, so my whole analysis kind of falls down. But I'm not sure what the proof is. One way or the other. But one fascinating thing I saw, a professor at Bar Ilan wrote a fascinating article. I mean, I'm not sure if this is a positive thing to make a point or not, and that is, the Ramban was the Gadol Hador in Spain. He really was the greatest of the rabbis of Spain. But he's coming to a new world. He's coming to Eretz Yisrael. He's coming to Akko. And Akko already has an established Torah leadership. Now, the Rash is no longer alive, but the Rash's Talmidim are there. And in some ways, they have different shitot than the Ramban. And the Ramban is kind of, although he's already 70, but you know, he's kind of an upstart, new man in town. So this professor postulates that the Ramban needed, again, not as an egotistical thing, but the Ramban needed to kind of establish his authority and his competence to this audience in Akko that did not automatically regard him as the Gadol Hador. And the professor points out, and I knew this, but I never realized the significance, that in the drasha, there's kind of a lot of autobiographical talk where the Ramban talks about when he was young, he would debate with this Baal Tosfos in France and this Baal Tosfos in France. And it's very chatty almost, in which he would be talking about the different discussions he had. But what's significant is that these were great legendary rabbis to these Balei HaTosfos. And the Ramban is saying that, you know, I spoke to him, and he agreed that I was right, etc. And this is an indirect way that the Ramban is saying, you know, I know your rabbis, I know your leaders, I corresponded with them, I spoke to them, and they acknowledged my analysis. So it's interesting that all of this chatty autobiographical information, which is actually quite interesting, actually had a certain point that the Ramban indirectly had to communicate to this new group of people that he is kind of, on one hand, one of them, and at the other hand, you know, he could do his own with all of those great rabbis because he argued with them then, and they accepted his various argumentation. Again, it's a fascinating point. You know, I wouldn't have automatically assumed that the Rosh Hashanah drasha was an attempt to establish his authority and his credentials, but that's a legitimate function. Again, I want to emphasize, the assumption is not, God forbid, that this was showing off or egotism or gaiva. But again, the Ramban is going to establish his own yeshiva there. And therefore, he needs to be accepted. He needs to be acknowledged as a legitimate leader there. Although I do believe the Ramban never got around, I mean, the Ramban was only in Eretz Yisrael for 3 years. He never got around to establishing a yeshiva, but I think that was his hope. The Ramban had many, 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 many Talmidim of great renown, but they were all in Spain. He does not have Talmidim from Eretz Yisrael that we know about. Just a few of his great Talmidim, the Rashba, Rav Shlomo bin Aderet, was perhaps his greatest Talmud, and he became the Rav of Barcelona. And then the Rashba's disciple was the Ritva, Rav Yom Tov ben Avraham of Seville. And the Ritva's Talmud was Rabbeinu Nissan, called the Ran, of again of Barcelona. And again, anyone that studies Talmud with commentaries knows that these are the greatest of the great, that these are the foundation of Parshanut, of the Talmud, and they are all Spanish. They represent a Sephardic tradition. The Ashkenazic traditions are Rashi and the Balei HaTosfos, right? So you could say the Balei HaTosfos lucked out a little bit because they got on the actual page, right? Commentaries of the Talmud are found in different ways. Some commentaries are actually on the page of the Gemara itself. And the two examples are Rashi's commentary is on the inner margin of the page, and the notations of Tosfos, which are many people, are on the outer margin of the page. Now, if you want to look at the writings of Ramban, Rashba, Ritva, or Ran, they are what people like to call the boys in the back, meaning to say, either they're in the back of the Talmud or they're in separate books. Now that already, just like I say with real estate, location, 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 right? What are the three most important things about real estate? Well, in some ways, that also becomes the fate of Jewish books. And that is, if you got yourself on the page, so you're almost unavoidable. You can't escape you, you're right there. When you're not on the page, somebody has to go get you from the bookshelf. All right, maybe I'll do it tomorrow, whatever it would be. So it is true that in the course of learning, the Ashkenazic commentaries got a little predominance precisely because they were on the page. Now, why are on that page? A lot of these decisions were made by non-Jewish people. I mean, the first printer of Jewish books was Bamberg, and Bamberg made a lot of decisions based on logistics or expense of typesetting or whatever it is. Although we have to believe there's some divine reason for those decisions being made. But printers made a lot of decisions of what goes on the page, what goes off the page. But still, even though these Sephardic commentaries didn't make the page, so to speak, but in any advanced learning, the commentaries of Ramban, Rashba, Ritva, and Ran are very, 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 very great and very eminent. And this is the school of learning that was founded by the Ramban. I had mentioned last week, forgive me for repeating, that the Ramban was the one who combined the Sephardic emphasis on halacha with the Balei Tosfos, bringing together all the passages of the Talmud. The Ramban was a bridge. And from his time onwards, there was a joinder of all of these methodologies. Okay, now let me point out, too, another thing, and that is the Christian kingdom of Jerusalem was utterly destroyed by the Muslims in 1291. So just 21 years after the Ramban died in 1270, the community in Akko, including the Jewish community of Akko, was massacred. And from 1291 until the end of World War I, the entire Eretz Yisrael remained under Muslim control, either for the Ottomans or some other Muslim entity. So 1291 is actually a significant date because that was the end of any Christian presence in the Holy Land. And for our particular purposes, it was the end of the Yishuv established by the French rabbis in 1211. And at that point, the main yishuv either Tzfat, it still was not Yerushalayim, but Tzfat had a certain dominance at different times, Tveria. So the history of the Holy Land during the period of the Crusades is a quite complicated and convoluted history. But it is important to know that there was this very significant Jewish community in Akko, founded by the French Balei HaTosfos by the time the Ramban came there. Okay. Now, one other point I want to mention, I want to just list for you and give a brief explanation of the writings of the Ramban, the main writings of the Ramban, so you have a sense of the great breadth of his commentaries. The earliest work that the Ramban wrote... Oh, I'm sorry, before I get there, I want to mention one other thing, one fascinating bit of information. One of the greatest French rabbis in the generation before the Ramban, was an iconoclastic fellow, Rav Zerachia Halevi. And Rav Zerachia Halevi was a brilliant, brilliant person. And back already in the 11th century, the first codification of halacha from the Gemara was written by the Rif, Rav Yitzchak Alfasi. Rav Yitzchak Alfasi was a Moroccan rabbi. Alfasi means from Fez, Alfasi. And the Rif codified halacha in a very unusual way. He actually follows the order of the Gemara, but he eliminates a lot of the discussion and gives you the bottom line in the language of the Gemara itself. So, for example, if you take any tractate of Talmud, a tractate of Talmud might be 100 dafim, so the Rif will be 25 dafim. And it's a way of learning the summary of discussions. So the Rif, this is the 1100s, this is before Rashi. I'm sorry, the 11th century, the 1000s before Rashi. The Rif was held in extreme reverence. The Ramban, for example, routinely refers to the Rif as Rabbeinu HaGadol. The Rambam based his Mishneh Torah largely on the decisions of the Rif. Now, the Rambam had a little chutzpah. The Rambam writes in the introduction, the Rif was so great that he didn't make more than 5 mistakes. So the Rambam already said, it's okay, okay. But be it as it may, the Rif was held in extraordinary reverence and was an extraordinary authority in halacha. Well, comes the Rav Zerachia Halevi, who lives in France, and this is in the, again, the 1100s, shortly before the Ramban, the 1100s, and decides to write a critique of all of the places in Shas where he thinks the Rif was in error. And Rav Zerachia Halevi was only 17 years old when he did this. And he wrote a sefer on the Rif, which is a total critique of the Rif, like every other law of the Rif, which he called Sefer HaMa'or, the Book of Enlightenment. It's a bit of a pun, because his name was Zerachia, the shining of God. This is the Book of Enlightenment. And he gave it 2 names, just as the sun and the moon, right? The sun is called Ma'or HaGadol, and the moon is called Ma'or HaKatan. So on the orders of Nashim and Nezikin, which are very big and long and more complicated, he called it HaMa'or HaGadol. In Seder Moed and Brachot, the holidays, he called it Ma'or HaKatan. And if you look in any Gemara in the back where they have the Rif, you will see on the bottom, Sefer HaMa'or. Right? And this is Rav Zerachia Halevi's critique of the Rif. And the critique is very, very fascinating. You see, he was a brilliant mind. He was a creative mind. He came up with all sorts of new interpretations of things. Nevertheless, the very first work the Ramban wrote, the Ramban was a very creative, innovative thinker in his own right, for sure. But the Ramban had a deep, deep, deep respect for the tradition of the earlier generations. And the Ramban wrote a point-by-point refutation of the Sefer HaMaor to defend the Rif. And he called this work Milchamot Hashem, the Wars of God. So you open up a Rif, just take a Gemara, look in the back of the Gemara, which has the code of Rabbi Yitzhak Alfasi, called Hilchot HaRif. At the bottom of every other page, not on every page, you will see Sefer HaMaor, and you will see Milchamot Hashem, which is the Ramban's attempt to defend the Rif from the critique of the Sefer HaMaor. And to this very day, one of the grist for the mill of many Rosh Hashiva Shiurim is to explain the machlokas between the Baal HaMaor, he's called, the author of the Maor, and the Milchamot Hashem. And as one rabbi once said, after he learns the Baal HaMaor, he is totally convinced that the Baal HaMaor is right. And then he learns the Milchamot Hashem, and then he's totally convinced that the Ramban is right. So the truth of the matter is, the arguments are so cogent and so powerful that you kind of see both arguments coming in. And the Ramban, by the way, in the Hakdamah, the Ramban wrote an introduction to the Milchamot Hashem. And he said a very fascinating thing. He says, halachic reasoning is not like mathematical reasoning. In mathematical reasoning, generally speaking, I know that higher mathematics even questions that, but generally speaking, there is only one right answer. If I ask two people what 1 and 1 equals, and one person says 2, and the other person says 4, that's not a matter of, well, we can have several opinions. Somebody is right and somebody is wrong. The Ramban says, halachic reasoning is almost never definitive or conclusive. Because you take the same texts and you take it sounds very modern, but this is what the Ramban writes. You take the same texts and the same proofs, and, you know, both people regard them as authoritative and binding. We don't simply depart from it. But they draw different conclusions, and they read them in different ways. And the Ramban says it's impossible to say this is wrong and this is right, but a person has obligated to go as far as their logic goes to be able to try to see what they regard as true, and that's what Hashem wants. That is the nature of the Torah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave to us. It's a very, what you might call a postmodernist statement about halachic reasoning, that halachic reasoning, the Ramban says, will by definition have a certain indeterminacy, but the Ramban's point is there must be a great, great respect for the authority of the earlier generations, and therefore we should try to validate and defend them whenever we can. And this is a theme. This was the first work the Ramban wrote, but this is a theme that permeates the Ramban over and over again, defending the greatness and the legitimacy of those earlier views. The Baal HaMaor was frankly a person who had little or no respect for preceding views. If he thought they were wrong, he just said they were wrong. And in fact, let me mention one thing that the Baal HaMaor said about Rosh Hashanah, which applies to the 300 rabbis who went to Akko in 1211. All of us know, obviously, that Rosh Hashanah is the only holiday that even in Eretz Yisrael we keep for 2 days. So this gives us a little feeling. We can have the horrid 3-day Yom Tov when Rosh Hashanah is Thursday, Friday, Shabbos. So it reminds us a little bit of the difficulties of the Golah. Because when we have a 3-day Yom Tov, they have it for Sukkot, and they have it for Shemini Atzeres, right? They have it 3 times. That's a little difficult. So here's what the Baal HaMaor says. The Baal HaMaor says, this was an innovation. He says, until those rabbis came to Akko bringing their French customs to the land of Israel, the minog in Eretz Israel was only 1 day. And he is the first person who ever said that. But he writes that there is no reason, I mean, we don't, again, hasten that, we do not paskin like the Baal HaMor. But the Baal HaMor says there is no reason to keep 2 days of Rosh Hashanah in the land of Israel. And the fact that they do so was because these French rabbis imported their Golah Minhag to Eretz Yisrael. Now remember, this is shortly after, this is, you know, within a few decades after this Aliyah. And the Ramban himself says, this is preposterous, this is crazy, you know, of course, you know, we go back and we have 2 days, how can you say this? And they even said, well, you got this idea from your father. Baal HaMor's father apparently was also a very iconoclastic, independent person, and people knew about this. You heard this from your father, and he doesn't know what he's talking about, etc. But in fact, I do want to say that the most recent historical evidence actually supports the Baal HaMor statement that the original minhag in Eretz Yisrael, even after the Churban Beit HaMikdash, was that Rosh Hashanah was only kept 1 day, and the notion of the 2-day Rosh Hashanah started in the 1200s with the Aliyah of the 300 Baalei Hatosos. It's a fascinating point because the Baal HaMor didn't necessarily know the history. The Baal HaMor was using reasoning to make an assertion that these fellows changed it. But in point of fact, his reasoning happened to be true, and it does reflect the actual history. So you could study this. It's an interesting question. When did they start keeping 2 days of Rosh Hashanah in the land of, in Eretz Yisrael, proper? Okay, so Milchamat Hashem is the first work of the Ramban, which is essentially his defense of the Piskei Harif against the Hasagot, against the criticisms of the Sefer HaMa'or. And obviously you understand the nature of this. This is really a commentary on the Talmud, because if you're defending the Rif's conclusions, you have to go back to the Talmud and explain all of the different passages so that the Rif emerges to be correct. Later, the Ramban wrote his own, his direct Chidushim on a number of tractates of the Talmud. This is simply called Chidushei HaRamban. Again, the Ramban's style in all his works is very brief, and one has to pay very careful attention. The Ramban will pack a very powerful idea in maybe 2 words, so if you're reading quickly, if you're scanning, you may miss the whole point, right? There are some Svarim that you can profitably scan, get the general idea. With the Ramban, it's very hard to do so because he may say a very important thing in a few words. So you have the Chidushei HaRamban. We have a commentary of the Ramban on the Book of Iyov, the Book of Job. We also have a commentary of the Ramban on the Book of Shir HaShirim, although some say that that is a forgery. So the Shir HaShirim commentary may be written by somebody else, but the commentary of Iyov is written by the Ramban. Obviously, to analyze the commentary of Iyov would deserve a course of its own. Let me just say one thing. The Ramban is one of the first authorities in the Jewish tradition to introduce the idea in the Book of Iyov of reincarnation, of Gilgal, because the Ramban uses it to explain, in part, the suffering of the righteous. Why do the righteous suffer? One of the ideas was it is a penance and an atonement for the sins that were created in a prior life. Clearly, this was derived from Kabbalah. This is pre-Lurianic Kabbalah, way before the Arizal, and the Ramban incorporated this Kabbalistic idea in his commentary in the Book of Iyov. There is a short little treatise the Ramban wrote, which is quite significant, called Igeret HaKodesh, the Holy Letter, which has been translated in English. And the Holy Letter, again, it's a very interesting subject. It is about the holiness of marital intimacy. And here, he takes issue with the Rambam, with Maimonides. Because the Rambam generally had a certain disparagement for the physicality of the body. Actually, it's actually based on Aristotle. The Rambam basically said, no, human perfection is based on the intellect, and the fact that you have to eat, you have to drink, you have to procreate. These are kind of regrettable evils that we have to do, because of the human condition, but they are not really the ways that a person becomes holy and close to God. There's a certain asceticism streak in the Rambam. And the Rambam says, of all of the human senses, the sense of touch is the worst. Yeah. The sense of touch is the worst, because touch is the most physical, more than sight and more than smell and more than hearing. So the Ramban wrote this letter to counteract that idea by basically saying that marital intimacy, a way of showing love and caring and affection, is a way of bringing godliness into the world. It is holy, it is sacred, it is noble, it is good. It is not just a concession to the Yetzer Hara. For example, Paul, the Apostle Paul, remarked that the reason God allowed marriage is better to marry than to burn in hell. Meaning, people are going to have sexual relations, so we give them a way to have it. The Rabban had a very, very different view. To this day, if somebody wants to understand Judaism's attitude towards sex and the like, and the Ramban makes the point that all of the laws of modesty are not because this is something to be ashamed of, but rather it is so holy and elevated that we don't expose it to the public. Igeres HaKodesh is an important text for people to be aware of in terms of a Jewish approach to sexuality. The drasha to Rosh Hashanah we already talked about. That's a drasha that's been written. We have an interesting book called Sefer HaGa'ula, which goes through the prophecies of redemption in Isaiah, Yeshayahu, and Daniel, going over the different calculations of Ga'ula. And then we have the great commentary on the Torah, which is considered to be second only to Rashi, which he completed in Eretz Yisrael. And then two more things. One is, the Rambam wrote, before the Rambam wrote the Mishneh Torah, which is his codification of Jewish law, the Rambam wrote a much shorter work called Sefer HaMitzvos. Sefer HaMitzvos is a listing of the 613 commandments of the Torah with a brief explanation of what pasuk they are based on and what does the mitzvah comprise. Now, the way the Rambam did it, the order is a little awkward, because we know in the 613, 248 are positive commandments, thou shalt do, and 365 are negative commandments, thou shalt not do. But instead of following the order of the Chumash, which mixes negatives and positives, the Rambam first gives you the 248 positives, and then he gives you the 365 negatives. That's the order that he wrote this. Now that's a little difficult, a little cumbersome, because let's take Shabbat. Shabbat is both a negative, lo sase bo malacha, do not do malacha, and it's a positive, bayom hashvi'i tishbos. Now, you would expect that we would have all of them together, but no. In the middle of the negatives is lo sase bo malacha, and then in the middle of the positives is bayom hashvi'i tishbos. So you have to go back and forth. Unlike the Sefer HaChinuch. The Sefer HaChinuch follows the order of the Torah, which mixes all of them together. Now, so Sefer HaMitzvot had two parts, therefore. I'll call it two and three because they're three parts, but part two is a listing of mitzvot asei. Part three is a listing of mitzvot lo tase. That's fine. But then the Rambam added a part one. And the part one, this is the Rambam, this is Maimonides. You'll see in a moment what Ramban did. Maimonides added a part one, which is totally unique, totally new. And that is, he gave us 14 principles exploring the methodology of how you count mitzvot. And let me explain why this was a real, real problem. This was a real problem, and the Rambam is the first one and almost the only one, who ever systematically addressed it. And here's the problem. We know from the Talmud that there are 613 commandments. That's the number we are given in the Torah Sheba'al Peh. And we know that it's 248 positive and 365 negative. That's your starting point. But the rabbis of the Talmud never give you a list. So the commentaries had to figure out various listings. But here's the problem. If you count every time God commanded something, go through from Bereishis to the end of Zos HaBracha, God commanding somebody to do something, you get a lot more than 613. You get around 5,000 commandments. So the question immediately presents itself, well, what do you count and what don't you count and what are the reasons for that? For example, the very first commandment, well, you might even say, and God said, let there be light. Okay, I mean, maybe that's a little absurd, but you know. Is that the first commandment? Well, spiritual. Okay, I don't want to get... I mean, Hasidus might say it actually is. You know, your job is create light. But halachically, we certainly don't regard Hashem speaking to the void, generate light, as a commandment. Okay, what about not eating from the Eitz Hadas? That's already given to a human being, right? So the Rambam develops principles. For example, the Rambam says that a mitzvah, a commandment that is not permanent, doesn't get counted. So if Hashem said, don't leave your mun overnight, even though that's a commandment, it's not one of the 613 because man is not a permanent thing. Or the Rambam says, you don't count parts of a process as separate commandments. For example, when the Torah says you bring a sin offering, so it says, and the Kohen shall shecht it, and the Kohen shall sprinkle the blood, and the Kohen shall burn the inner organs. You don't count that as three commandments. One commandment called bringing a sin offering that has many subcategories. Or, on Shabbos, there's a prohibition against doing 39 types of malacha. We don't count Shabbos as 39 prohibitions. We don't say, there's a prohibition to write, and a prohibition to have fire, and a prohibition to harvest. We don't do it that way. We simply say, there's only one prohibition. Don't do forbidden work on Shabbos. That happens to embrace 39 categories. Because you see what the Rambam is doing. Otherwise, you're going to run out of numbers. Meaning, if you're limited to the 613 number, you got to figure out a way in which everything is subsumed. So this was, again, it's a technical problem, to be sure. But the Rambam was the very first one who systematically developed criteria, you might call it scientific criteria, for how you count mitzvos. How do you characterize them in broad categories? What is counted? What is not counted? When are multiple steps, for example, tefillin? Tefillin is counted as two mitzvos. A mitzvah to put on hand tefillin, arm tefillin, and a mitzvah to put on head tefillin. But tzitzit, to have four corners on the garments of four fringes on the garments of your clothing, that's only counted as one mitzvah. And the Rambam explains why that's so. Lulav and Esrog, even though you're taking four species, it's only one mitzvah. Right? So the Rambam goes through this. So that's what part one is. So part one are the 14 principles as to how you count the mitzvot. And part two and three are the results of that analysis by your 248 positives and your 365 negatives. Now, the Rambam, in many cases, used the Sefer HaMitzvot to attack or to argue with earlier compilations of mitzvot that the Rambam felt were not faithful to these logical principles. And the particular authority he attacked was the sefer from the Gaonim called the Hilchos Gedolos. And the author is one of the Gaonim, Rav Shimon Kayara. and he is known as the Bahag. Bahag is just an abbreviation, Baal Hilchos Gedolos. So the same way Rav Zerachya HaLevi attacked the Rif for making all these mistakes, the Rambam essentially attacked Rav Shimon Kayora for erroneously counting different mitzvos that he shouldn't have counted based on a faulty logical methodology. A faulty illogical methodology, and the Rambam had different proofs. So, Ramban, following the consistent path of his life to always defend the authority of the earlier generations, did a similar work on the Rambam Sefer HaMitzvot to what he did on the Baal HaMa'or Sefer HaMa'or, and the Ramban wrote Hasagot are criticisms to the Rambam's Maimonides Sefer HaMitzvot, and these are called Hasagot HaRamban. Now the Ramban is doing many things there. First and foremost, he is defending the Baal Hilchos Gedolos against the criticisms of the Rambam. But here, he is a little less deferential than he was with the Rif. When it comes to the Rif is always right. With the Bahag, it sometimes works this way. He defends the Bahag, but then he says, but you know, the Rambam does have the better argument. There are times in which Ramban concedes to the Rambam's position, but says, I can offer up a defense for the Bahag. So the deference to the Bahag is not as significant as his deference to Rabbeinu HaGadol, which is what he called the Rif. But in addition, the Hasagot to Ramban are not only about defending, that's one of his goals, but he actually has substantive disagreements with the Rambam, meaning he counts the mitzvos differently. Sometimes the Rambam will count something as part of something else when the Ramban said it should be something else. Now, obviously, you understand that there is a certain tension here, because if you're wedded to the number 613, you do understand that every time you take away a mitzvah and you make it part of another mitzvah, you got to have something else to make up the number. It's kind of like a jigsaw puzzle. So the Ramban does that as well. And once again, this Sefer HaMitzvot with the Ramban's Hasagot is truly, truly a classic. Rav Shimon ben Semach, who was one of the great, great Spanish Achronim, late Rishonim, early Achronim, several generations after the Ramban, said that if a person studies the Sefer HaMitzvot with the Ramban's comments, then whatever Torah knowledge he had before that study is like klipat hashum, it is like the peel of a garlic, a very thin little thing compared to what he will know afterwards. And in modern times, the Brisker Rav said, remarked that he felt he became a Talmud Chacham by studying the Sefer HaMitzvos and the Ramban. And if you think about what an important limud it is an important limud, and it's not done in yeshivas, which is, again, one of many regrets. And that is, it really tells you, what are the 613 commandments of the Torah? Where are they derived from? And what is the exact scope of what each pasuk is telling you? This is very fundamental. What is God telling me? What is rabbinic? What is Doraisa? And it's a way of schematizing the actual structure of the Torah itself. Now, in this connection, I mentioned last week, but now I'm going to mention it again, one of the most notable machloksim between the Rambam and the Ramban in the mitzvos is the mitzvah of living in Eretz Yisrael. And I had mentioned this. Maimonides does not have a mitzvah that is called living in Eretz Yisrael. Nachmanides does have a mitzvah called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And we talked last week, why didn't he come earlier? So either it was life-threatening, or he was needed in the Golah. But Ramban is of the position that there is a mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. I didn't get to everything I want to talk about. I do want to talk about Nachmanides' position on Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Hopefully next week I will get you, a copy of the Vikuach of the Ramban. But I still have to talk about Yishuv Eretz Yisrael and its place in the overall thought of the Ramban, because that is a very, very significant component of all of his writings. A final work of the Ramban I just want to mention, which I think I may do after this session, is he wrote a magnificent treatise on the nature of reward and punishment, including Mashiach, Olam Haba, and Tchiyat HaMeisim. So if you ever were confused about all of these differences, Mashiach, Olam Haba, Tchiyat HaMeisim, the Ramban is your man. He wrote a treatise called Shar HaGemul, the Chapter of Reward, in which he goes through all of, like, what is the difference between Gan Eden and Olam Haba, for example. Ramban goes into all of that, and he analyzes the views of Rambam, Maimonides, and he points out differences in view. So we're not going to cover it this session, but it might be the next thing we do. So essentially we'll have a double Ramban session. Okay, have a good week, and we'll see you. Yes. Yeah.